For a lot of us, a slow internet connection is an irritation that hampers communication for a few seconds. But imagine your life without even the basics of telephone service. No fast communication other than running out the door and yelling to your neighbor, heading to the post office, or jumping on a sled to physically deliver your information. That's how it was for a lot of rural Alaskans before the 1970s. Today, we're discussing a new book that chronicles the early days of the telecommunications network in rural Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. We are taking a break from politics today on Election Day.
Shocking.
and instead, we're going to talk about the early days of connection in rural Alaska. Finding Alaska's Villages and Connecting Them is a new book that takes us to a time when shortwave radio was the option for communication over distance, and that had its drawbacks. Here to discuss how things changed with telecom service is author, engineer, professor, any other titles I'm missing, sir?
That's fine.
Dr. Alex Hills. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being here. Also joining us is one of my mentors, my icons of broadcasting, Nellie Moore. Hi, Nellie.
Uvla lotak.
So great to have you both in the studio with me. I feel really honored to have you here. Nellie got started in journalism and broadcasting at KOTZ in Kotzebue. We'll be talking about her dad's legacy in radio and her own and what it meant for the people of the Arctic. We'll also take your calls if you have a memory of how people communicated across the distances before phone service in rural Alaska, or how it changed your community. Or if you have a question for Alex or Nellie, you can give us a call. Statewide, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Before we launch into the history of the telecom system that your book does a really amazing job of laying out in a nice conversational tone, too, Alex, there it is for those of you in television land. I was a little apprehensive thinking, okay, this is probably going to be really technical and engineer-y, but it's not. It's a very nice narrative tale of life in rural Alaska. And so before we kind of get into that, though, how about if the two of you just set the scene for us and tell us about how you first started working together in Kotzebue?
Well, I stepped off the plane in 1973. I was being recruited to become the general manager at KOTZ. Now, just that alone is an interesting story because back in those days, public radio didn't have any money. And it was easier to find engineers than managers. Yeah, so now you've come full circle.
Full circle.
And so anyway, they needed an engineer and they needed a manager. So but engineers were harder to find. So the approach was to recruit an engineer and then say, oh, and by the way, you're also the general manager. Mm. And that's what happened to me. So I stepped off the plane and waiting at the airport were Mr. Ed Ward and his effervescent young daughter, Nellie Ward. Nellie later, as most people in rural Alaska know, became Alaska's leading native journalist. But then she was just a young 19-year-old, kind of spunky, actually.
I find that really hard to believe.
Kind of feisty.
Yes. Wow.
All right, that's enough.
Anyway, after spending an hour with Nellie and her dad, Ed Ward gave me instructions. He said, take the job. And 2 weeks later, I was on a plane back to Kotzebue. That's how I met Nellie.
We were really nice, you know, that first visit.
kind of rope him into it.
Yeah, we get him into town and then get him into a place, and then it'd be harder for him to extricate himself.
Later on, I found out that some of the duties of the general manager were making the coffee in the morning, changing the paper on the teletype machine,
yep.
et cetera.
Wow. It's amazing, just in this number of decades, how amazingly advanced telecommunications have streaked toward the future. So I want to discuss the actual VHF systems, but first tell us about how it came about. As you lay out in your book, Finding Alaska's Villages, the U.S. Air Force owned and ran the Alaska Communication System, ACS, and in 1971, it was purchased by the Radio Corporation of America, I love that name, RCA, for a little over $28 million. What was RCA's interest in this system? That's a lot of money.
Well, the Alaska Communication System, as you said, was run by the military up until 1971, and it carried traffic from those radars out in western Alaska that were keeping an eye on the Soviets. And then, as kind of an add-on, they used the term the Alaska Communication System for the civilian traffic that the Air Force allowed on their system. So that meant that it was effectively the long-distance telephone company for Alaska. RCA was interested in becoming the long-distance telephone company for Alaska, and so they bought the part of the system that carried that civilian traffic. As one of the conditions, though, of that purchase was RCA promised to provide telephone service to the villages. Specifically, there were 142 villages that were designated in the contract, and those were the ones that RCA made a commitment to, in addition to the more profitable markets like connecting the cities and places like that.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are discussing a new book called Finding Alaska's Villages and Connecting Them. It's written by Alex Hills, and in the studio with us are author, Professor Alex Hills, and longtime veteran broadcaster Nellie Moore. So the RCA said that they would provide telephone service to 142 villages. Why did they agree to that?
It was mostly because the people of Alaska insisted on it, or at least through our elected representatives. So the state government, as a condition of the purchase, said, well, we need you to provide service to all these communities that presently have no service. And in those days, in the early 70s, the villages really weren't connected in any serious way. You usually had one or two shortwave radios in a village, and that was their connection to the outside world. In the book, I've got this great picture of the aurora, right? Mm-hmm. And the aurora looks pretty in the night sky, but it really disrupts shortwave radio. So, and that happened a lot, especially in the northern part of the state. So the communication service really was, I guess I can't say it was non-existent, but you had the village health aide in a village had a shortwave radio that it was usually a woman, used to communicate with a doctor in a regional hospital. And that was the connection. And healthcare was dependent on that communication connection, as well as all other kinds of communication, like ordering supplies and repair parts for the snow machine and you name it. So something really did need to happen.
And they did have an office in Kotzebue where the Earth Station what used to be down in the downtown area. But the only other way was you could go to their office and send a telegram. But there was, you know, no two-way communication over phone or anything like that. It was really old. And there are a lot of ham radios here in Anchorage, you know, who have a lot of radio experience, who probably know a lot about what some of the things we're talking about.
Right. 1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-TALK is the number statewide. If you have a memory you'd like to share about those early days of the telecommunication system in rural Alaska, or what it was like before the communication system was put in, or if you have a comment or question for either Nellie or Alex. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. And the book is called Finding Alaska's Villages and Connecting Them. And there it is. So when the shortwave radio systems were in, and as you mentioned, Alex, they were really important for village health aides. It was their only method of communicating. They had like a daily radio call. At least once a day they would call and talk with the doctor. What happened when the aurora was out, when the northern lights were flashing around? What did that do?
Well, this is where I tried to stay away from a lot of the technical stuff in the book, as you mentioned earlier. But the short version would be that the aurora is a layer of the atmosphere a few hundred miles above the Earth. And it's basically composed of ions, which are electrically charged particles. And these electrically charged particles are what make shortwave radio work. It's what makes the shortwave skip. So the aurora is a big storm in the ionosphere. And so the ionosphere is disrupted, so shortwave communication is disrupted.
And was it disrupted only when you could visually see the northern lights, or was there a lot of going on? Because I know that in the book you say sometimes it could be disrupted for days.
Days or even a week or two in some cases. Yeah, so it wasn't only when you could see the northern lights. But if the aurora was active, that would be an indication that shortwave was probably going to have problems.
And Nellie, when those interruptions were going on, people had to make do, I suppose, if they had injuries or there were illnesses and you couldn't talk to a doctor.
Right. And that communication was with Anchorage. But there were still, you know, like I said, there was CB radios and local things, which they had ways of communicating that they'd been using for a long time. So, plus, while there wasn't any long distance, there was, we had telephones, believe it or not, but everybody was on a party line. But, you know, there was some limited communication, but you couldn't call outside of the town. So it was very remote and sometimes very hard.
We might want to make the distinction between villages, which is the focus of the book, the small communities, and then regional centers. Kotzebue was a regional center. Kotzebue had an RCA or an ACS facility and telephones that connected through that long-distance network that I talked about that the Air Force ran. But the smaller places, like in Northwest Alaska, Kayana, Norvik, Selawik, and others, they didn't have any phone service. All they had was that shortwave connection. And then, as Nellie said, in many cases, CB, but that was only inside the village. Mm-hmm. But the long-distance connection, like to call the doctor or to call for other kinds of help, that was shortwave radio, and that was all they had.
1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. We're discussing the early days of the telecommunications system in rural Alaska and how it really changed both the lives of people in rural Alaska and how they probably saw the rest of the world and themselves also through telecommunications. 1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK is the number statewide. In Anchorage, 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. We're in the studio with author and former, not only KOTZ general manager, but the founding member of the station that we're at right now, KSKA. Dr. Hills, Alex Hills, was the founding general manager here.
I only have two remaining claims to fame in public broadcasting. One is that I hired Nellie. Well, I worked with Nellie. And the other is that I hired Beattie.
All right. That's fantastic. Well, let's go to the phones. Kate is in Anchor Point. Hi, Kate.
Good morning. Thank you for having this really fun program.
Yeah. Did you have a question?
No, I have a couple comments. One is, there was a radio program in Bethel in the 70s and 80s. I believe it was called Thunder Drums, but I could be wrong about that. But what the program was an opportunity for people to call in from the villages to wish people in other villages happy birthday, happy anniversary, congratulations on the birth of your granddaughter. It was just the most wonderful, heart-opening, heartwarming program, and I tried never, ever to miss it. So I know that those things aren't really going on anymore, but it was an awesome, awesome thing, and it was because communication was so difficult from the villages to other places. And so anyhow, I just wanted to comment on that. The other is, you mentioned CB radios in terms of people communicating with each other intra-village, and I was a public health nurse there, so I spent a lot of time in the villages, and CBs were going in homes and in the clinics and everywhere. And depending on what the discussion was on CB, everybody had their own channels and things or whatever. People knew their friends' channels, so you didn't necessarily have to be listening to everything that was going on a more commonly used channel. But it was common for people to do that. And so discussions that were happening between families, two, three at a time on CB, it was just really wonderful. It felt so family. The community was together on CB. It wasn't always nice, you know, so then you just turn it off. But know that. But a lot of times it was nice, and there were things, you know, discussing who's coming to the birthday party and, you know, just wonderful things like that. And because I did public health nursing, of course I had to report to the hospital, to the doctors, to report cases and kind of see what the next step might be for that person in the village. And we had radios that not only connected, you know, from where I might have been in Imanak or Alakanuk or something to Bethel, but we also connected with Russia. And when I turned on the radio in the morning, sometimes I would get what I'm sure was a Russian aerobics class. It was unbelievably fun. So anyhow, I just have beautiful, wonderful memories of communication before it was so easy.
I think right about Tundra Drums, and many stations have had those throughout the course of their history, including the big station in Fairbanks. You might remember KJNP, everybody called it King Jesus North Pole. But in the rural stations, like Kotzebue and others, they still do that. They have a call-in every day where they give the family news, because there's a lot of people out there that, for example, when I lived in Noatak, we were in the new section of town, which didn't have telephone service. So, you know, there's still kind of a mishmash of stuff out there, but those services are still exist. And I don't think they'll ever go away. It's a very, you know, you think about it when you have a fundraiser here at KSK, very important to the survival of the station. Well, in the bush, when they have them, they really highlight that service. And it's really wonderful to listen to.
It would probably be good to mention, you know, you started off with the ACS and the lack of communications. But before we were able to really do much about that problem, it was really public radio that came in and started to provide that missing connection. Mm-hmm. Now, in rural Alaska, KYUK was the very first public radio station.
Yep.
KUAC in Fairbanks was on the air before that, but in rural Alaska, KYUK in Bethel was the first. And then Nellie and I are happy to say that KOTZ in Kotzebue was the second. We were, for a time, the northernmost radio station in the United States, mm-hmm. at Kotzebue. And then Barrow called me on the phone. And Barrow said, would you help us start a public radio station? And I said, well, we're the northernmost right now.
We don't want to lose that title.
You know, but it's really hard to overemphasize what a unifying force for the community, mm-hmm. those public radio stations were. And since most of my experience was in Kotzebue, it's KOTZ is the one that we talk about in the book. But another kind of community, we did a couple of other community things in the morning. And I was the morning, I was the guy on the radio in the morning, Alex in the morning, they called me. And we had teachers and parents from the villages sending in cassette tapes. Remember cassettes?
yes.
And we had a lash up where we could play the cassette tapes over the air, and they sent in cassette tapes of the kids in school singing their songs, reciting their poems, whatever it might be. And people in the villages, they just loved that. They loved hearing their own kids.
Of course.
Another one we did in the evening was we did what we then called Eskimo stories, and now it's Inupiaq stories. Mm-hmm. And we had the elders on the air telling their traditional stories. You know, there's this whole oral tradition passed down from one generation to another, and that was continued over the radio station. Now, as the general manager, that put me in an interesting position because the general manager is responsible to the FCC for everything that goes out over the radio. But I don't speak Inupiaq. So anyway, we just kind of went with that one. But really a huge unifying force. And then, Laura, you were mentioning before on air that you read in the book some of the dedications, the song dedications,
yes.
And some of the other things that we did. So it really does bring back lots of memories.
Well, and along that those lines, the dedications on air and those the tapes coming in from people in villages around Kotzebue, the advent of messaging, Tundra Telegraph, Caribou Clatter, the names that stations gave to their messaging, I didn't realize until I read in your book, Alex, that that wasn't really legal, that the FCC sort of looked the other way when these personal messages.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, in FCC terminology, you have a common carrier like a telephone company, and that they're under regulation that allows them to send messages, voice or telegram, from one person to another, from one to one. Broadcast is supposed to be broadcast. It's supposed to be one to many.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was in that sense that services like Tundra Telegrams didn't really exactly fit the regulation, but no one really cared that
all
much.
All right. That's fantastic. Let's go back to the phones. Dave is in Talkeetna. Hi, Dave.
Hey, good morning. Great topic, especially for me. I started reading Willie Hensley's really good autobiography. And he was living just in the Kotzebue area, just a wee bit north.
Did you have a question?
Well, I was just going to tell about our communication system. When we were first in the Talkeetna area, actually we lived across a couple of rivers and up kind of off the Tulitna River, about mile 131 on Park Highway. And most of our communication was CB radio. We discovered lots of neighbors that way. I kind of missed that. But our communication to outside was courtesy of Dorothy Jones, who later became the mayor. She ran a grocery store in Talkeetna, but she had a real telephone. Just on her own, she provided this wonderful service of patching RCB radio messages out over the phone, and especially at Christmas time and stuff like that. She would let you talk to your relatives.
Wow.
And it was a really wonderful service that Dorothy provided for
Dave,
no charge and no expectation. It was really nice.
Yeah,
Dave, did you have a handle on CB radio?
Yes, we were Kiwi.
Kiwi.
my wife was a New Zealander at that time.
Oh. Well, thanks so much for the call, Dave. And when he was talking about CB radio to the one telephone, I was reminded of being a kid in the village I grew up in, where we had a payphone downtown, and that was part of our entertainment at night. Was there was not much to do in a community of 199, and so the gang of kids would go down there and take turns yelling into the phone, because if you yelled really, really loud without any money in there, your mom could still hear you. You sounded like you were on the moon, but that was how we entertained ourselves, making free phone calls at Ma Bell's expense. Let's go back to the phones for a minute, and then I want to get into more of how the system was actually built in rural Alaska. Peter is in Fairbanks. Hi, Peter.
Yes, good morning. I really enjoy your show. I just wanted to comment that I was in Nome, Alaska in 1977. I was working for radio station KNOM,
woo-hoo!
Which was broadcasting at that time and still is.
Yes.
And the gentleman mentioned messages. We used to call them hotlines, and they were very, very important. We had them twice a day, and I just would like to relate two that were sort of funny. One was the postal person in Gamble wanted us to send the combination to the safe on the hotline, and we had to explain that it was going to go out over the air to everyone. And
that's
the second
great.
One was we got a hotline from an individual, a male, and he said, "I found mine with yours." And we said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, I found my wife with your husband." And we said, "Well, we can't send that out over the air either."
Oh, dear.
And they were really good days.
Peter, it's great to hear from someone that works with KNOM. Actually, there were three of us engineers that built KNOM, Tom Bush, John Pfeiffer, and I. And probably when you were there in 77, the voice on the tape that said, KNOM Village Hotline, was me.
Oh, that's great. I'm really glad you related that. They were just great days. I would also like to give credit to KICY,
yeah,
which was the Protestant station there at the time. We got along quite well with them. I just wanted to mention one other thing. I was a teacher in the bush in 83, and in those days we had satellite phone at the school. We had one satellite phone, which had a very bad echo. And lastly, we had RatNet Television, which many people don't know today, was the Rural Alaska Television Network.
They call it ARCS now. State. They call it ARCS now.
I like RatNet better.
I do, too. It's more memorable.
Well, thank you so much for your show. I really enjoy it, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the call, Peter, and we will talk a little bit more about RatNet, and we're going to get... promise that we're going to get to how this system was actually built in rural Alaska as we are on air today on Talk of Alaska, not talking about politics. We're talking about this great new book, Finding Alaska's Villages and Connecting Them. Alex Hills and Nellie Moore are in the studio as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. It's a fact. 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're in the studio today with Alex Hills and Nellie Moore talking about Dr. Hills' new book, Finding Alaska's Villages and Connecting Them. So we're talking about the early days of the telecommunications system in rural Alaska. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or in Anchorage, 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So back to the system. RCA buys, you start installing, Alex. Describe the VHS system, what it was at that time before it moved into the more advanced system, and also the mobile phone that was the size of the trunk of a car.
Right. So when RCA bought the system in 1971, and then the first technology that they tried to use to serve the village telephones was a VHF, very high frequency radio system, which was an adaptation. Now, this was before cell phones, way before cell phones. Mm-hmm. But in those days, you could get a mobile phone in your car. And it was kind of a clunky contraption, and that was the, and there was a big radio, remember vacuum tubes, you know? There was a big radio that went in the trunk of your car, and then there was a little telephone handset under the dashboard. That didn't sell very many units, it wasn't very popular, but that was the kind of equipment that RCA adapted to install in the villages, and they asked me to be the team leader to actually install those phones. Well, I mean, long story short, it wasn't really a very good system. Mm-hmm. But we struggled, and there are stories in the book about, struggling to get these phones to work, and some of them worked and some of them didn't work so well. But eventually, one of Alaska's great telecom leaders set things on a track, and that was Augie Hebert, who mm-hmm. is very well known in the world of broadcasting. He owned three radio and TV stations in Anchorage and two in Fairbanks, that Channel 11 in Anchorage and Channel 11 in Fairbanks were Augie stations. Augie, although he was successful as a broadcast owner.
Commercial broadcaster.
We didn't even have public broadcasting mm-hmm. back in those days. But Augie was also really public-spirited. I mean, I don't think I know anyone who was more oriented to serving the public than Augie. And so, and in the book, you know, I talk about his many accomplishments, but Augie was the guy that originally said, you know, I think satellite communications would be the way to do this. And eventually, after some negotiation with the state, and that's a story that, you know, takes a little bit of time to tell, but eventually, satellite communications was adopted by RCA as the way to serve the villages, and that's where the caller mentioned about the satellite, village satellite telephone, and the Echo and things like that. But mm-hmm. that was the very first real reliable system that went into the villages was when those satellite earth stations went in, and the very first one was right in our backyard in Kotzebue. It was up in Notak. That was the first one, and so that was when we got on the right track.
The was Emonic the first village that you started working in, or where did you first start? It seems like I remember from the beginning of the book you were flying out to Southwest Alaska. Where did you start with the system?
Well, you know, when you tell a story, you have to sometimes you just start with the more interesting ones. No, it wasn't the first one. It's just the first one in the story. But
okay.
the cover of the book has a photo of a float plane taking off, and that represents flying out of Lake Hood, flying west toward western Alaska. And in those early days, there were many, many villages in western Alaska that we were trying to connect, and we always took off from Lake Hood.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones for a moment. Mark is in Bethel. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. This is a great topic, and I'm glad you wrote the book there, Alex. I haven't had a chance to see it yet, and I'm sure looking forward to it. So just a couple of quick things and then a question for you. The last time I listened to KNOM, yours was still the voice of Village Hotlines.
That's fantastic.
And we still, birthday call-in and the Thunderdrums messages are still a staple on KYUK here in Bethel.
Yay.
The single sideband system, I mean, it was, you know, every village had a couple of radios. You had one for the clinic, you had one for the school, and of course the use of that went back a long time, and it used to be fairly inexpensive dinner time entertainment listening to people literally around the state, clinics calling and making their doing their radio medical traffic, which interestingly enough is still what they call when the doctor in the hospital has a telephone conversation with health aid. They still call it RMT.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard a really funny story from in the older days, health aides were much younger. So I talked to a lady who was essentially the health aide when she was 16 years old, and a mom came to her in a panic. Baby is sick, and I don't know what to do. High fever, so she goes up to the school to use the radio. And of course, it's nighttime, pitch black. She's scared to death. She goes in. She tries to call the hospital. No answer. she says, gee, what would the doctor tell me to do? So she went back, gave the baby a shot of penicillin, went and checked the baby the next day, and the baby was fine. She goes up to the radio, calls the hospital, and the doctor just went up one side of her and down the other. And, of course, everybody in the state could hear it. But it was an interesting time when they were using when the schools and the clinics were using those. My question to Alex is: do you mention two real pioneers of Alaska telecommunications, Vinod Batra and R.J. Moran? Are they in your book at all?
Well, thanks very much for your call, Mark. I remember Vinod Batra very well. You know, as I said, when you tell a story, you just kind of have to pick and choose. And so to be honest, Vinod is not in the book, but I certainly remember very well United Utilities. Maybe for other listeners, I think a little later we'll probably talk about OTZ Telephone and how we put the first telephone exchanges in behind those satellite earth stations. And then shortly after us, Vinod Batra led United Utilities and did the same thing with the villages, essentially in the Chulista region in southwest Alaska. Interestingly, Vinod and I were neighbors in Anchorage, so we talked about all this. But I certainly remember him well, and I've kept in touch with him off and on over the years.
Well, tell us a little about Robert Merrick, Bob Merrick. He was called the dirty-handed engineer.
That was my
word. Sounds like a gunslinger, but he was a sort of instrumental in the advancing of the satellite concept, was he not?
He was. So this comes back to the village health aides again, mm-hmm. who were struggling with this shortwave radio system that we were talking about. And although Augie Hebert was maybe the first visionary about how satellites would work well in the villages, the very first chance that we had to try that out was when NASA, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, made a satellite available to us to use as an experiment. And so we experimented by letting those village health aides use that satellite on a reliable hookup. Well, I'm going to spare you the technology and the ionosphere, but it took a special kind of antenna to make that work. There's a photo of the antenna in the book, but it looks like a corkscrew, like you'd use to open a bottle of wine.
Yeah, that was an interesting photo.
And that was invented by Bob Merritt, a professor at UAF up in Fairbanks. So he was another one. He's another one of the heroes in the book who really helped to get this satellite thing going.
And was the first big Earth station in the state the Bartlett Earth Station in Talkeetna?
Yes, that was the very first one. And that was Augie's idea.
And why Talkeetna? Why was it there?
Gosh, I don't really know the exact reason for that. Maybe they had some space up there. I'm not really sure. Hmm. But Augie, through his energy and enthusiasm, convinced ComSat, which was the Communication Satellite Corporation, to build an Earth Station in Alaska. And that was the one at Bartlett, up near Talkeetna.
Hmm. Well, let's go back to the phones for a moment. Steve is in Skagway. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how's it going today?
Good. Did you have a question?
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Did you vote?
Not yet. Soon, though. Pretty soon. At lunchtime. So I've been here for only 40 years, and when I first got here, when you made a phone call, you only had to dial the last four digits.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's how it was in the village that I grew up in, too.
And I thought that was great, and I don't know why it was changed to dial seven digits, because the population hasn't changed all that much, you know.
I just remember it was an annoyance because you had to dial three more numbers.
It took a while to get used to it.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Steve.
That's all I got.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And Alex, we had an email from someone wanting to know where the book, Finding Alaska's Villages, is available in Alaska, local bookstores. Where can they find it?
Right. Well, the book is just coming out. And so there are, at this point, two bookstores in Alaska that have it in stock, but you can order it from any Alaska bookseller. The two that have it in stock are Fireside Books in Palmer and Gulliver's Books up in Fairbanks. And it's also available online, but the caller, or the emailer, I guess, asked about bookstores in Alaska. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be available in other bookstores soon, but it can certainly be ordered from any of the other ones other than the ones in Palmer and Fairbanks.
All right, fantastic. Let's go back to the phones. Harvey is in Petersburg. Hi, Harvey.
Hello there. I just wanted to make a connection with Alex. We once had something going between us. I can't recall exactly what it was, but I worked in Petersburg, Alaska for a long time and in the area, and I first started with the White Owl System in 1961 and then was with the beginning of RCA Alascom here in Petersburg. And so we went through a lot of what has been talked about on your program there. We had ended up, I and my colleagues, taking care of five earth stations in Central Southeast, and we had some of those VHF links with the OGE radios, and I just had a reporting career doing those things, and it seems to me like, Alex, that you came to Petersburg for some reason or other in the 70s.
Harvey, I remember you well.
That's fantastic.
So this was in connection with the VHF radio phone system, which we called in those days the Bush Telephone Program. Harvey, you were the station chief at the RCA Alascom station there in Petersburg, and we used your shop and your facility as a base for the phones in Cape Pole, Point Baker, and Port Alexander. How's that for a good memory?
Yeah. Well, at Cape Pole and Port Alexander were smaller stations, and there was another one at Tenakee Springs, and finally one at Point Baker, and then we had a VHF radio link that went from Point Baker to Port Protection, which didn't work well. We ended up trying to make it work with a stacked array of four Yagis, and anyway, that's all changed a lot, and there's a lot of water under the bridge, but anyhow, it was a rewarding career, Alex, and I remember you being here, and so congratulations on your career and so on, and this new book you've got out.
Thanks, and you'll be glad to know that some stories from Petersburg and Port Alexander are in the book.
All right. Well, thanks. Thanks for the call, okay. Harvey.
All right. Take care, sir.
I wanted to talk a little bit about your dad's role, Nellie, in communications, and the fact that Ed Ward received an award from the FAA for saving polar bear hunters. Tell us about what happened there.
Well, he was just kind of a crazy radio guy. You know, he had a ham radio, and we had all kinds of radio parts, tubes and stuff like that. And we grew up having to take the test, you know, and get our call letters. And anyway, he turned into being kind of like the repair shop if someone had something go wrong with their radio. But he also copied the Russian weather, which we could receive really well in Kotzebue because we had a rack of radios upstairs. So he was, I don't know how he learned to get into radios. But anyway, he had us doing it. And, you know, I would always find the tubes that somebody needed and put them in the tube tester and make sure they worked. but anyway, the polar bear hunters would go out on the ice. Kotzebue was like the polar bear hunting capital of the world back then. That was before the Marine Mammal Protection Act and sure. Polar bears became protected. So these were polar bears that were massive, and so they were very popular to hunt. Even though we seldom saw them out of Kotzebue, they weren't like a daily occurrence like they are in Barrow. So anyway, the hunters would come in, they'd fly out in their Super Cubs or out with the guide out onto the ice for many, many miles, and needed a reliable means of weather forecasting. Mm-hmm. So Dad had learned Russian, and he copied the Russian weather that came out in Morse code on the radio, and then he would translate it into English and give it to the polar bear hunters so they would be able to expect what kind of weather there would be near or beyond the dateline, whatever they might be doing. And at one point, a plane didn't make it back, and he also worked at the flight service station, which was one of the busiest in the state. And so occasionally there would be searches, and a plane had gone down, and it was nobody knew where it was. They were really, you know, flying around looking for it. Well, Dad came up with this idea that maybe their radio could receive but not send, because what might ever might have happened to the plane. And so he figured out a way where he kept calling out to the plane, and then finally heard the static noise, and here the guy was
wiggling a wire
on his battery. And so they figured out kind of a Morse code communication, so that Dad figured out where they were out on the ice, and they were able to rescue them, and everybody made it back okay. But
so fascinating. And your dad taught himself Russian so that he could translate those weather forecasts, is that
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And I seem to remember that Nellie learned a little Russian too, and that she learned the Russian word for brother,
which was brat. And I enjoyed it at the time. You know, I was young enough where I really enjoyed calling my brothers that, because I'm sure I was very annoying.
And I'm sure they were annoying to you as well. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Helen is in Bethel. Hi, Helen.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I witnessed my Auntie Betty Guy, the first health aide in this region in Kuitluk, Alaska, using the VHF radio system to save TB lives because it was rampant. And I also witnessed my dad starting implementing the YKHC Corporation, city government, IRA counseling, and Talisto Corporation beginnings, where he was gathering everybody in the villages who were the head of the IRA in cities. And to me, that was the most awesome. He'd get a phone call. We had our first phone in the rural cap in the Kuitluk store, and he phoned everywhere for that, and I was recording everything. I'm like nine, and I, you know, like, And it made me a teacher, counselor, and social worker, and I didn't know he was giving me all that administrative stuff over the VHF.
Well, it sounds like you had some great memories from those early days and the one phone in Kuitluk, and I think that Helen's call illustrates the importance of those early communications and getting the word out and back and forth between people.
One of the things was that this was in the days of the BIA boarding schools and St. Mary's boarding school and others. So the kids went off to boarding school when they went to high school, and just being able to just call them on the phone was a really big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, when your kids are at a distance like that. So let's talk a little bit about what happened when Governor Hammond came in, and there was an important role between lawmakers Chancey Croft, Jay Kurtula, and trying to get $5 million. Tell us about that, Alex.
Right. Well, I think this gets to one of the themes of the book, which is a lot of the successes we had were because people worked together. People at the professional, technical level, people in the community, and even people in state government. They worked together and they cooperated. And so there was a crucial moment where another one of the heroes of the book was a guy named Marv Weatherly, and Nellie remembers Marv. He was Governor Hammond's telecommunications director. And in order to get this Earth Station program going, Marv needed $5 million. This was before the pipeline. This was big money, $5 million. So Marv is quoted in the book. Marv said that Marv was a Republican, Governor Hammond was a Republican, and they needed support in the Senate. And the support they got was from two Democrats. Hmm. One was Chauncey Croft, and the other was Senator Jay Curtula from Palmer. So I rest my case.
They got their $5 million. And on that note, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion about finding Alaska's villages and connecting them, the early days of the telecom system in rural Alaska.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com, and by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
From military might to counterculture cool to camo chic, camouflage in plain sight exposes the ancient yet modern art of concealment. See camouflage at the Anchorage Museum through February the 5th. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Elizabeth is in Fairbanks. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
You have a question?
Yes, just wanted to say that for a number of years I worked for the Alaska State Employment Service, otherwise was known as the Unemployment Office, but during the late 60s and clear up into the middle 70s, we were recruiting people for Job Corps centers, we were getting the Alaska Skill Center in Seward started, and our core population who were going to take advantage of these various training opportunities were in the bush. And if you couldn't find somebody who would run downriver to tell somebody to get on an airplane on Tuesday, yeah, you'd utilize the local radio stations and any other means. And then it gets on to the whole business of the Native Health Aids. And ultimately, we were able, because of the beneficent of having ARCs, and or used to be the satellites that were available for public service, we were able to put actual job announcements in 210 communities where we would prepare the job openings in the Fairbanks office, and they covered everything from Wrangell to job openings in Wainwright and at the new mine in Red Dog and clear along the northern coast of Alaska. And I have always wished and hoped that those kinds of possibilities were still out there for, you know, public service to do its kind of thing. Yeah, I love modern communications, but by golly, we had fun with that old one.
So, all right. Thanks so much, Elizabeth.
Really quick, I remember every day on KOTZ we did employment information, and we had one of those offices in COTS, which I'm sure worked with you, and so we'd always read their job announcements.
Were you looking for another job?
In our final few moments here, Alex, let's talk a little bit about the actual telephone system and the advent of kind of regional carriers, OTZ among them.
Right. So after we finally got those satellite earth stations in the villages, then at that point, each village had only one telephone. The whole village had to share one telephone. So then the next obvious step was to put the telephone exchanges in behind those earth stations so everyone who wanted a phone could have one. And Nellie and I were both involved in founding OTZ Telephone. This is Northwest Alaska. Mm-hmm. The book, I talk about, well, it's obvious how OTZ was formed, but for outsiders who read the book, they would say, well, why OTZ? And of course, it's the airport identifier up there. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing that got that whole phone company started in the beginning, because the people in Kotzebue were very unhappy with their phone service. They're all nice people, you know, and they don't really like to complain. There was the Alaska Public Utilities Commission, you know, and there was a regulatory authority, but still people didn't like to complain. But then something happened. There was a basketball game, and our team was playing in Dillingham. And because of the local phone company, the broadcast was interrupted. Well, phone service is one thing, but basketball, Now, that's really something. And that was what kind of got the ball rolling on starting OTZ Telephone, which first took care of Kotzebue, and then later on the villages. And we did get telephone exchanges in the other villages in our region, which there were 10 villages. It's the Nana region. That was the same as the service area for OTZ. And then you had a caller earlier that talked about United Utilities, and then United Utilities and other phone companies across the state did the same thing. They put exchanges behind the earth stations, and so now pretty much in most villages, someone who wants a phone can have one.
And going back to the game in Dillingham, you ran some sort of wire across the football field and connected it to a phone so that Nellie could have the broadcast of the game in
right.
Kotzebue.
Army battle wire, yeah. I had been a Signal Corps officer, so I knew about battle wire.
I can't imagine how excited people were, though, to actually have the game broadcasting in Kotzebue from Dillingham.
Mm-hmm. Well, when the owner of the telephone company got angry because there were only 3 outgoing long-distance lines to Kotz, and a ball game took up 2 of them. So he decided to pull the plug. Well, everybody was just mad as heck, calling the radio station. And I was like, I don't know what happened. I'll find out.
And so the Alaska Public Utilities Commission actually traveled to Kotzebue as a result of this incident. Mm-hmm. I think, as far as I know, it was the first time they had ever done that. Mm-hmm. They had an official hearing, and
we kicked butt.
Yeah.
Did the guy lose his job?
He lost the telephone company.
That was how...
Even worse.
Yeah.
Well, we bought it.
We bought him out, yeah.
Well, it's, you know, as you both well know, what the work that you did in rural Alaska certainly has changed the lives of people there. And
okay, I got to tell you one thing really
quick. Please do.
The OTZ telephone guy, when they were getting all these earth stations done, he calls me up one day and I'm at my mom's house and he says, we just hooked up Deering. Do you want to make the first call? I was like, sure. Mm-hmm. So I called this lady in Deering. She's my aunt. I was like, hi. She said, where are you? I said, I'm at mom's. And she's like, how are you calling me?
and their history was made.
Yep.
Thanks so much to Alex Hills and Nellie Moore for being in the studio with me today. It was a lot of fun. The book is Finding Alaska's Villages and Connecting Them. This is Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and I will be back here at 9 p.m. with live election coverage. So tune in again.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.